Oh, thank you so much. My name is Adam Levin. I'm alcoholic.
Adam.
All right, so I that put it really succinctly, I guess. That's what I'm supposed to do every time I talk to my parents for a little bit today. They're still in New Jersey, and every time I tell them I'm going to go speak to me, and my dad asks the same thing. He goes, well, what are you going to talk about? And I always say, fly fishing. I've never been fly fishing before in my life. I don't know why that's funny. But yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I have to talk about, because he asked me, and thank you so much for asking me. I have to talk about what I was like, what happened to me, what I was like before I met you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then what happened here to make this make any sense. And the way I'm supposed to do that, they say something really interesting in how it works. Talks about our stories disclosing in a general way what I used to be like. And that means I got to tell stories. You know, that I don't have to have a message. I mean, I kind of got one. And if you don't like what I have to say or if I'm not coming from my message clearly, you can just read that because that has it. Like, that's the deal. It's almost like insurance to the whole thing. It's like, we're going to put that up and then we'll zone out and be like, oh, yeah, step seven. That'll work. Good meeting. But I got to tell stories because I don't have, like, my sobriety date is December 31st, 2006. Just to give you guys something to judge before I get started. My sobriety date is December 31st, 2006. I have a sponsor. Just so we are clear about my sponsorship relationship, I told him that I was speaking about 2 hours south, and he made sure to be there just in case anybody had any questions. So he's here, and my girlfriend is here, and another sponsee brother of mine is here. And I'd really appreciate them coming down to support me, or judge or support, however they want to do. My girlfriend is here for verification purposes only. It's like, what do you do when? Okay. But I say that to say this, to say that, like, I've read our basic text in Alcoholics Anonymous literature multiple times, and I have heard countless AA members speak, and I have studied the Big Book, and I have studied the 12 and 12, and I have worked the steps. And I can tell you that if I were to tell you guys about all of that, there is nothing new or interesting about any of that, because all of that can be found in your own experience. Like, I could tell you what I did to work the 12 steps, but that might not look anything like what your experience is with the 12 steps, and that's okay. You know, in some cases, I would prefer that your experience was different because mine was interesting. But the most valuable thing I have, and it says this a couple times in our literature, and it's really spoke to me every time, the most valuable thing I have in my life is my experience of what it looks like to be alcoholic. What does it actually mean for me to have alcoholism? And the reason for that is because I don't know. You know, when I came to AA, I heard a lot of stories about people's drinking, and they were the first people in my life who talked to me about their drinking instead of talking to me about my drinking. You know, like my parents talked to me about my drinking, and school counselors and lawyers and judges talked to me about, and doctors talked to me about my drinking. And I never responded to that ever because they didn't really understand my drinking. If anybody ever told me to stop drinking, they did not understand my drinking. They did not understand what drinking did for me. But when these people talked about their drinking and they told stories about it, I could identify with them, not because they were talking about some overarching set of feelings, but because they were talking about circumstances that I could identify with. And because they brought their own version, like their own life about what alcoholism was, they were able to get me. And this book is really just a contribution of 100 or so guys who did the same thing. And that's my job. When I show up here, I've got to contribute what alcoholism looks like for me to the group, to AA, in the hopes that somebody who comes in here has that feeling that they talked about, that they read in the beginning of this chapter, in the beginning of this meeting. It was so important. I must have this thing, I am like you. So in order for anybody to say, I am like you, I have to tell you about what I was like. I have to. And that's my job. So I'm going to try to refrain from proselytizing or really talking about my opinion of the steps. I think they're just splendid, I guess. I mean, like, thumbs up the steps and Alcoholics Anonymous and all that. Traditions are cool, too. No, like, if I would be permitted to say, I think the steps are beautiful and the traditions are the most important contribution Alcoholics Anonymous has made to the world. In some combination of everything, I've found some place where I've been put in contact with a power greater than me than I had been separated from for my whole life. as far as I could remember, it has given me a place to do things and to suffer through things and to accomplish things and to be a part of things that I would never have had the power to do without Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful to even be considered a member. Like, I've been told I'm a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's the best compliment I can get today. So I can say that confidently, and now I can tell you stories about peeing in my pants. I was never a puker. Like, I was never somebody who threw up. I was told in a meeting last night that throwing up that women's relationship with throwing up is way different than men's relationship with throwing up, which completely boggled my mind because, like, I never thought about it as, like, a gendered thing. But I knew the guys that I was hanging out with, and they was always be like, they poot and rally, and then they go, and they throw up in the toilet or whatever party they were having, because that's how you're a guest. If you're alcoholic, you throw up in their bathroom. But I never did. Like, I was never, I threw up maybe 3 times in my life, and 2 of them were sober because of food. And, like, I think once was because I tried to take vodka and cranberry juice in a funnel. And the first time I tried to do that, my body said, no. And the second time I tried to do that, my body said, all right, I guess this is what we're doing now. I guess we're doing this. It's like donut number 5. It's just like, all right, just send it through. We're not going to do it. So we'll deal with this later with diabetes when you're 50. Like, we're not going to make a deal about it right now. But I was a pee-in-your-pants guy. Like, I was a pee-in-your-pants guy. It consumed a lot of my thought, like how and when and what I was going to do if and then when I peed my pants. And ignoring it and laughing it off did not work the first time I tried it, so I knew I had to come up with other options. I think my first tentative solution was just going to be that I just didn't drink any water the day before, like the day I was drinking. Because I knew I was going to go out, so I'm not going to drink any water. And hopefully, like, the water and the booze is just going to sort of fill the hole. And that didn't really work because nobody needs to consume that much water in their day. Like a 24 rack and a handle of Jack Daniels is too much water, and your body's going to get rid of it eventually. That's all the science I know. And so, like, that problem, that didn't solve that problem. So it was just how much clothes am I going to wear to sort of compensate for what's eventually going to happen. And, like, 2 sets of boxers didn't work. Like, shorts underpants didn't work. But the recipe that I settled on for, like, the last year or so of my drinking was that I was going to wear, like, my pajama pants and then a pair of jeans and then another pair of jeans when I went out. So, like, I was just going to do that. Like, that was my... Ha ha! Like, I figured that out, and so that was what I did. And I was a college student at that time. Let's just say I didn't tell that story to anybody until I came to AA. This was not like my, hey man, check out what I figured out how to do. Hey man, like, posting on Facebook, just like, I cracked it. Like, hashtag winning. No, like, that was not what it was like. So a lot of my story is waking up and realizing that I've peed my pants, or waking up and realizing that I went to bed and doing all that. And that is not a thing I brought into AA. Like, that is not like, oh, I'm alcoholic, but I've also got this weird bedwetting thing. Like, I've not wet the bed since I got sober. Yet, I guess. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. Like, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not going to say that. Just for today. But that was because of my drinking. That was a consequence of my drinking. That was just the way my body responded to it. And I just view that as a totally acceptable consequence of my drinking, and that I was just going to have to figure out my way around it. You know, that's what my drinking was like. Okay, I guess I'll get back to that, because it's pee in my bed is part of my story. Let's see. I'm 27 years old. I grew up in suburban central New Jersey, right outside Princeton. My family has nothing to do with that university. I don't mean to suggest that I'm that smart. It's a landmark. You guys know where Princeton is. It's somewhere that way. And my parents were and are still together. They were a very loving nuclear family household. Upper middle class. My father worked as a securities lawyer in Midtown Manhattan. And my mom was home with us. They both had law degrees. They were both very smart, very educated people. And I got a sister who's 3 years younger than me. And that was what life was like. You know, like, I didn't want for anything. I was very well taken care of. They were both, my mom is a Christian. She's Texas. And my father is Jewish by culture, but not by religion. He stopped practicing. He stopped practicing Judaism in any way at about 18 when his mom died. My mom went from breast cancer diagnosis to death in about 3 months. And he never really Like, that was just the way he processed that. He was basically just like, you know what, no, not so much on the God thing. But he was still a very morally centered, focused guy, like, believed in right and wrong, believed that you should think about the risks of what you're doing while you're looking at the rewards of what you might be doing, and make educated decisions about, like, how things affect other people. And, you know, my mom has been a evangelical Christian since she was growing up, and that was how I was raised. I was raised in the Church of Christ, in central New Jersey. And I participated in that for a little bit, and that was just sort of the way, that was the way things were starting. Like, that was what my starting gate looked like, right before I sort of became conscious and, like, really developed memories. And all of my memories were horrible. Like, all, like, I did not look fondly back at my childhood once. I remember being intensely emotional, like, intensely, it was never the high highs, it was never the low lows, although I had them. It was just the commute between them that was just, like, horrible, because I would make that commute, like, 10, 15 times a day, and it was just, like, just hard, because I'd be so excited about something, I would get so obsessed with one particular topic at a time, and, you know, for a while it was church. Like, I just wanted to fit in and be a part of a church, and I wanted to fit in and be a part of a school, and I wanted to fit in and be a part of it with my friends around my house, and I just never really did. It never really clicked. So it went from, like, the elation of, like, feeling like I did something really intense and good, and, you know, like, the Sunday mornings I would like, hang on the preacher's words and just be sitting and so elated by it, and go into youth group and feel like I'd finally found, like, the key to something, and then leave, and by Monday that would be gone, and I realized that everybody at school hated me and didn't want anything to do with me, and that I was never going to fit in. Like, I always had that feeling like I was, like, a week late, and everybody had already made all the friends they were going to have for the rest of their life, and, like, I was just going to sort of try to butt my head in and try to cut my way in. That was what I felt like, so I did that, and that those are, like, my memories of growing up. Like, I remember being intensely scared. Like, I remember one time, like, I wanted to impress, like, my family. They were all there for the holidays, so I don't know, like, learn, I'll tell you two stories about me growing up that are kind of indicative. So, like, I desperately wanted to impress everybody. So, like, I was obsessed with Michael Jackson at that time. And so I, like, wanted to learn, like, one of the dances from one of his music videos. So I practiced that, and I learned that by myself for, like, weeks. Like, I'm not hanging out with people very often. I'm just sitting in my room dancing to something and listening to my headphones. Not that different from today. But I'm doing this, and then finally I bring up the courage to ask my mom to, like, can I dance this for everybody? And she's like, yeah, sure. And everybody comes upstairs to my room, and I'm so scared to do it that I hide under the bed and I just wait for them all to leave. And so, like, I remember that. I remember that just being this thing where it's like, you know, I never, like, that story, I never got over it. You know, I never got over the shame that came from that. You know, I thought about it. I thought about it over and over. I would never go back to, like, you know, it was never, it got compounded by so many little shames and so many little fears that it just came to be like, why, you're such a piece of crap. Like, you are so awful. Like, why can't you impress anybody? Why can't you do what you need to do? Like, why can't you do this? You know, that was the way, that was sort of a walking around sort of fear. The other side of that, like, the arrogance and the defiance is in this one. Like, I remember being a little kid, and my favorite movie at the time, this was a couple years old, my favorite movie at the time was watching The Little Mermaid, and I watched The Little Mermaid every single day, like, multiple times. That does not make me alcoholic. I've heard of non-alcoholic kids doing that. They're just kids. They're idiots. They don't know what they're doing. But at the same time, I also suck my thumb a lot. And my parents, they didn't want to do, like, the hot sauce thing that some people do. Like, they were not spankers. They were not, like, corporal punishment at all. They were not that guy. My dad, they were both lawyers. They were like, if we explain this to him, he will figure out what to do. So they made a deal with me. They were like, okay, listen, if we catch you sucking your thumb, you can't watch The Little Mermaid. You can't do it. We're not going to allow it. And I said, all right, fine. And I haven't watched The Little Mermaid again to this day. I just didn't want to do it anymore. It became like, I want to do this. I like doing that. I can just don't need to do that anymore because I'm going to suck my thumb until I very well want to stop. Thank you very much. And they'll tell that story to me and be like, yeah, we knew something was up. We knew something was up when that was happening. And we were like, yeah, he doesn't mind never watching The Little Mermaid ever again. We have a sick child. I wish that was as sort of colorful and as bland and beige. Like, right now, it's basically just like middle class white. Like, we just sort of bleed into the wallpaper. Like, we're not interesting at all. But it became alcoholism relatively quickly afterwards. I was my relationship with. Thank you so much. I thought I was getting the hook for a second. It was like, we're at Disney church here. No, but
You kids with your Pixar.
No. Thank you. Again. My relationship with alcohol started from watching my dad come home from work. My dad had a 52-minute commute home from Midtown Manhattan every weekday, and he would park his car at the train station and then come home on the train, get in the car, and drive 5 minutes home. He would walk in at about the same time every day. I've been home for about 3 hours, and we'd sit down basically right after he got home and have dinner. And once a month, he'd have a particularly hard day. You know, he dressed not unlike the way I'm dressed now, and he would get home and his tie would be off a little bit and his collar would be undone a little bit. He had one of those. And he'd say hi to my mom and say hi to me, and then he'd go to the little cabinet next to our pantry. We called it the butler's pantry. Didn't have a butler, that was just what we called it. I have to explain that to a lot of people that I go to meetings with up in Northern Virginia. They're like, oh, butler, weren't you? And I'm like, no, okay. So he'd open the butler's pantry and he'd grab a cup. And that glass was made specifically for Scotch whiskey. And he would grab a cask, and out of that cask he'd pull an 18-year-old bottle of Oban Scotch. And he would uncork it. No matter what I was doing, I would hear that cork. And he would pour two fingers of Oban whiskey into a glass. He would pour not three fingers, never three fingers, never one finger. He would always pour two fingers of Scotch into this glass. And I would see him wandering around the house with it, just walking around, seeing what me and my sister were up to, seeing what mom was making, help my mom make dinner if he wanted to. They were both cooks. And then he'd take a sip of it, and he'd just go like this. And I saw something happen to him that wasn't actually happening to him. Like, he was just, like, having a drink after work. He did not put any thought into that drink. But what I saw happen was, like, man... Gentleman, is what I saw happen. I saw, like, stressed, relaxed, like, tense. I'm not going to drink from that again. I'm not that committed to the role. But I just saw a guy just be able to take a deep breath. And I was just like, that's what alcohol does. That's what that does. That's what I didn't know the science. I was just like, that is what that drink does to that man at that time. And I saw that, and I just wanted it. You know, I just wanted it. I wanted to try it. And whenever we would go on these holidays and it would be around, I would ask my dad for a sip, and every once in a while he'd give it to me, and I would taste it, and it didn't taste good at all because a sip of whiskey doesn't taste good. It tastes like someone is punching you in the head from inside your head. But I always wanted. I wanted to feel that feeling. I wanted to feel what it felt like. I wanted to be grown up. You know, so that was the way I perceived alcohol. Up until my first drink, which happened right on time when I was about 13 years old. We were on a cruise in the Southern Caribbean, and I had been hanging around my parents for a couple days, and my parents wanted to go do their own thing, so they basically said, go make some friends. And so I'm wandering around the side of the boat just trying to figure out what I'm going to do or whether I'm going to jump off the boat instead of making friends. Like, I entertained the idea for a second of just, like, doing one of those and... I eventually decided not to jump off the boat because when we mustered, they talked about, like, the camera system that they had underneath, so I figured that they were just going to catch me and it was going to be an embarrassment anyway. So I went around and I followed around a bunch of kids that looked like they were about my age. In fact, they were a couple years older than me, and they were looking for kids a couple years older than them to buy them booze. And I gave them all the money I had in my pocket, and they ended up finding some older guys to get two handles of 120-proof boat brand vodka called Svensk. And man, I didn't know how good that stuff was. I did not drink enough to appreciate 120-proof boat vodka. Like, I looked for it afterwards. I was like, that seems like it would probably be a deal. But we cracked that open, and we passed that around in somebody's bunk. I didn't know who any of these guys were. And to me, that meant that they were looking at me, and when they asked me what my name was, it was like an accusation. It was like, explain yourself. I don't know about anybody else, but I've always had the walking around feeling that I got to apologize for, I don't know, existing. Like, my name's Adam. I'm sorry. Like, I'm sorry if I offended anybody or if there's anything. Like, just give me a couple minutes. I'll be whoever you want. Just give me a heads up. Sorry again. Sorry for asking. Sorry for apologizing. Sorry. But so that's what I feel like. So they're passing around this bottle. I take a swig of it. And I, like, cannot believe my mouth. Like, this is the worst. This is the worst thing. And in that instant, I know there's something wrong with me. Because, like, if this is what my dad was drinking, I'm not like my dad. This is not deep breath territory. This is like I am gasping for breath territory. But I keep this in my face. Like I'm like, I can't tell anybody what, and so I'm looking, I look like a popped zit at these people. And so the bottle goes around again, and I take another swig, and exactly the same thing happens. I'm like, this is not getting any better. Like, how many times are we going to do this? And then the third time, and then I showed up here. Third drink that I had is the most important event that's ever happened to me in my entire life. The third drink that I had, I'll tell you what happened at that moment. The third drink I had, I opened my eyes, and I was surrounded by a completely different group of people. They looked and were dressed exactly the same. But their eyes just got kinder. Like, their faces, like, they were excited to see me. People I was terrified of were taken away and replaced by the best friends I'd ever had. And it wasn't because of anything of who they were. It was that I just felt the sense of disconnectedness that I'd always had, like, just went away. And I would never have been able to describe that. I would just describe it as, like, it felt bad and then all of a sudden it felt good. I would say all of a sudden I got drunk. But I don't know if I got drunk. I know I just got the effect produced by alcohol for the first time. That sense of ease and comfort that comes at once upon taking a few drinks, I got at 13 years old in that cabin of that boat that day. They asked me what my name was and who I was doing here, and it didn't feel like an accusation, and I said my name, and I didn't feel ashamed, and that was a big deal. You know, like, I felt like I had just made really good friends. Like, I don't even know if I associated with alcohol. I associated with partying, I guess, I just made really good friends. I didn't know any of their names, and I barely remembered what they looked like. That night, I went into a blackout, and I woke up at 4 a.m. having urinated on myself. If I was drinking, like, if this was the way the boat was structured, and I was drinking at, like, Kate Winslet from Titanic, I was drinking, like, up on that level, I woke up in, like, Leo DiCaprio at the bottom. Like, everybody was wearing uniforms. Like, I was in employee sections of the boat. I'm 13 years old, I'm wearing just my underwear, I've just peed on myself, and I'm passed out in the middle of the hallway. And I wake up confused. I start trying to figure out and get my bearings, sort of doing like the and one stagger, and like the terror hasn't sunk in yet because I still got like a nice handful of drinks in me, and I'm like, all right, I'm just gonna go home, I guess, and then sort of wander back up, picking up pieces of my clothes like on the floor, like in the middle of like the big flowing staircase. I've got my shirt, and I'm like, all right, I'm just put that on, why not, you know? And basically what it seemed like happened is that they dropped me off based on the trajectory of my clothes depositing. They took me back to my room, and I wasn't done partying, so I just left and was just taking off pieces of my clothes as I was wandering through the boat. And that's the best assumption I can give to you what happened, because I got no idea. And I never saw any of those people again. So I crawled back up to my room, and I'm banging on the door trying to get back in. I'm holding my clothes, I'm banging on the door, and my sister, who's 9 at this time, 9 or 10, just looks at me like really confused and gives me one of those bemused, confused, dismayed, shame looks, like, what, really? And, like, I blow right past her. My alcoholic instinct was put foot on floor, put other foot on bed, and go to bed, and the room won't spin. And so I did that, and I put on a Coldplay album, and I just listened to it, like, over and over and over and over, and over again until I went to bed, just going, like, oh, this is great. And I woke up, and that was close to, like, the end of the time we were going to have on the boat. And I woke up, and I was instantly like, I was not instantly like, I have to drink again. I was like, I have to find my friends. And we were going to leave. Like, everybody was de-boating, whatever that word is. So we were doing that. We were all getting off because they were done. And we were one of the last groups. So I stood at one of the entranceways of the boat, and I watched everybody go by to look for my friends. And I didn't recognize or see a single face. And I was just like, okay, so the only friends I ever made in my entire life are gone now. Like that was the way I thought about it. So it was not an on the whole like good experience, but I just remember there was like something happens when I drink. Something happens when I drink alcohol that I really enjoyed. And the next time I drank consciously, and that happened again, you know, I was home and I was with a bunch of people that I was really scared of, and I don't even remember the exact circumstances of it. I remember going to your regular after high school or after middle school party and having a bunch of unnamed liquor beverages. Like I don't even really know, but I just remember that it all of a sudden made sense. It was like, okay, if I drink this, I don't feel like the way I do normally. And that was a big deal for me. Like, at that moment, like, alcohol became the thing that made me okay. And as long as I knew I was going to be okay, this guy, Jonathan, in D.C., used to say this thing where he says, as soon as I drank, I realized I didn't hate life. I just hated sobriety. And I really identified with that a lot, is that I did not hate the whole world and everybody in it anymore. I just hated being sober. You know, so I would just try not to be sober as much as I could. In the beginning, it wasn't as often as I would have liked, because it's kind of hard. When you look like me, which is like subtract 10 years from how old I really am, and you're 12, which means I look like a 2-year-old, you're not going into a store and be like, can I have a handle of the purple one? You know, you don't have that. So I'm relying on people and stealing from parents and doing stuff like that to get alcohol. But whenever I could, I did. You know, the question was never, when alcohol was around, the question was never, am I going to drink? Because I was. You know, like that was something that was made clear in my early experience in AA, was that people were, you know, people in AA gracefully tried to like sort of raise the bottom such that I could meet it, and I could sort of see where I was going. And since I never got arrested exclusively for alcohol, I never had a DUI or anything like that. The thing that got me was they said if alcohol was ever around, were you ever not going to drink it? And the answer was always just no. Like, no, if alcohol was around, I was going to drink it. And sometimes I didn't want alcohol to be around, and it was around, and I drank it. You know, like that was for me, I could not control my drinking. It was always just like, there was always this scarcity in my head where I was like, if I don't drink this right now, I might never be able to drink it ever again. So I'm definitely going to drink it as soon as I can. But that was how I sort of found alcohol, and that was what it did for me. And high school improved dramatically as soon as that happened. Because I knew that there was a solution. I knew that there was something that could happen to make that feeling of anxiousness, that feeling of, like, dis-ease go away. So my grades instantly improved, my social life instantly improved, and everybody just sort of put together, like, I guess he evened out. And in fact, I mean, every great thing that happened to me after that, I gave the credit exclusively to alcohol. It was like I started drinking, and I started getting a lot of friends. I started drinking, and my grades improved. I started drinking, and my whole life just seemed to get better. You know, and I remembered that stuff whenever anybody told me, Adam, you got to stop drinking. Adam, you got to stop drinking. That stuff is killing you. I'm like, no, it's not killing me. It's setting me free. Like, me drinking is the only reason I'm here talking to you right now. You know, that was what alcohol did for me. You know, from a very young age, nothing was ever me. Nothing was ever what happened. It was always that I was drinking. And I took that all the way through middle school and high school and the beginning of college. You know, like, whenever I could drink, I did. Whenever I wasn't drinking, I wanted to be drinking. And whoever was talking about drinking, I wanted to be close to them. And I started getting, like, I was on this real sort of arrogant streak, and, like, that part of my personality sort of came out. Like, I was, at the same time in high school, like, at the same day, I was substitute teaching an AP history class for, one of my professors who, we found out later was alcoholic and killed himself. I was substitute teaching that AP U.S. history class, and around the same time, I don't know if it was that exact minute or, like, a couple of hours later in the day, one of my friends was called into the principal's – was called in, like, the guidance counselor's office and said, I know you've been hanging out with Adam Levy, and we don't really think that he's a really good influence on you, and you should probably steer clear if you want good things to happen. Like, I am teaching a class and a bad influence, like, at the same time. Like, that should give you as much of a hint to my duplicative and sort of, like, two-sided personality-ish. Because, like, I could be – you know, just like the third step says, like, I could be really nice and kind and generous when I wanted to be, and I could be really forceful and angry when I needed to be, and just it was all about just getting that feeling okay, just feeling okay for a little bit, and then just once I felt okay, just doing whatever it was I wanted to do. And I got decent enough grades. The decision of where I wanted to go to college was made pretty exclusively by what kind of drinking life I was going to have there. So I went to a school in central D.C. called American University. I cared about two things. It was, they studied politics and they drank. Regardless of whether or not it was a dry campus, they drank. And I instantly was like, I found a home. That was my first choice. I went. And I walked onto campus. I realized that I could completely discard everything that I was ashamed of about my life and completely start and be a brand new person. So I did. And I really did feel like I'd arrived when I went to college. You know, like all the restrictions and all the stuff, like my relationship with my parents started to get very scattered. Like I would show up and I would be drunk, or I would show up and be stoned, and they would be expecting me to do something, and they would just start being more disappointed. And my father and mother would try to reason with me and be like, "This isn't good. Like you're not making good decisions. This stuff is going to factor into the rest of your life, and you know you probably don't want to be doing this stuff if you have like big ambitions and big goals." Like, they're trying to reason with me, and I remember my dad sitting down one day and trying to walk me through like a Ben Franklin, like a pros con. He called it a Ben Franklin, and people in AA just called it an inventory. But they He tried to walk me like when you're thinking about making a decision, think about the risks involved in making that decision, and think about the potential rewards you get out of making that decision, and then look at both of them and figure out what you want to do. And for me, that always just seemed like way too much work. Like, I was just like, I want to go do that, and I already have done it, and that didn't work out so well. Oops, and like never think about it ever again. Like that was the way I did stuff. So my parents were losing their minds. They just didn't know what to do, and their relationship started to get a little bit like fraught. Like they were fighting a lot more because they were fighting about trying to figure out what to do. And my mom was like more church, and my dad was like absolutely not. Church is not the answer. I stopped going to church after a little bit because that feeling that I got from being in church, I realized was temporary, and that they really didn't have the solution to my life. Once I started drinking, it all made sense. And so I just like started rabble rousing and asking my preachers questions he couldn't answer, and he'd be like, "Well, I guess you got to pray about it." And I was like, "No, I won't be back." And you know, thinking I was really smart and thinking I neatly evaded the God idea, just like. I think I became an atheist mostly for the friends, than for any real sort of idealistic thing. Like, I identify a lot with everything they talked about in the second step, especially in the 12 and 12. They're talking about all these different evasions that they had, and I've used all of them at different times just to escape that first general bitterness that being in church and being in youth group didn't fix me the way that I thought it was supposed to. And so that was, my relationship with them wasn't very good. Like, my grades are starting to drop, but I can still get into college, and I'm thinking that everything's okay. Everything's fine. Whatever. I'm drunk enough so that I have this baseline of, like, everything's, it's all right. You know? And it's everybody in my life who's noticing that, like, something's wrong. Like, something's going to go badly with this kid. Like, he's been able to skate from consequences long enough. Something bad's going to happen. And so when I went to school, they're looking at this with, like, a sense of apprehension. They're like, I really hope he figures it out. Like, I really hope he's doing okay. And I was like, like, I am going to get drunk immediately. And I got drunk immediately, and it was fantastic. I made a bunch of friends, and we all got drunk immediately and often. And that started an incredibly unproductive 3 semesters at American University. I think my last semester there, I went to a party, and we were doing that thing where you, like, have a breathalyzer, and you're, like, playing a drinking game that involves math, and like, trying to never, ever have – if anybody wants to go back out, by all means, do so. But never have a pocket breathalyzer, because then you're just in a competition with your own level of consciousness, and that could just never go well. You know, like, I'm not going to be like, 0.17. I wonder what 0.18 feels like, you know, and just do that. And so, like, I blew on a pocket breathalyzer higher than my GPA at the time, and I was really proud of that. Like, yeah, I love AA. That's a joke in AA. It's great. You can get that's a joke. You can write that down in a book. Everybody else is like 1.2, no 0.27. That's how I was the high. Yeah, so I did that, and you asked me how I was doing. Everything was great. I was making more friends than I'd ever made. The stuff I was learning in school was interesting. Everything was going great. At the time, by my last semester, I was like 110 pounds, like soaking wet. I was smoking like 3 packs of cigarettes a day, such that like my skin was this like orangey brownish color and it matched my teeth perfectly. And like I had a very casual relationship with personal hygiene. And like I knew personal hygiene. I could be like high, but like he'd walk in the hallway and I'd be like, I'm gonna take an extra step to the thing. And that was like the extent of our relationship. Like I showered sometimes. I had long sort of stringy hair, and I could never grow facial hair, but I just didn't shave it because I didn't know how, and so I just kind of looked like a malnourished frat boy golem, like, and just sort of like and like just not just sickly, like all the care that I ever put into how I looked went away when a girl that I was dating in college broke up with me. I thought that we were going to get married. I thought that like it was the big first relationship. It was like I have transformed into a person that finally somebody likes. And you know, for Christmas I asked my parents for plane tickets to go hang out with her family in South Dakota, and so we hung out there. It's cold there. Don't go. Don't go. So I went. And I went in December. What's wrong with me? And flies die in South Dakota in the fall. That's how cold it is. So I went, And she broke up with me. She said she wasn't in love with me anymore. But this was after about 5 or 6 conversations. I was like, wow, you get drunk an awful lot. And I was like, yep. And it never made it clear to me that that was like a subtle 21-year-old way of saying, like, stop, you're scaring me. I remember one time we were at a house party in McLean, Virginia, and we had just had one of those nights where I drank 20 drinks as fast as I could. It passed out after about 30 minutes, and she drank the same number of drinks but over like an 8-hour time span. And the next morning we woke up and she asked me, why don't you drink fun? And I asked her the same question. I was like, why don't you drink fun? Like controlling your drinking in the way that it seemed like she was doing it didn't make any sense to me at all. Like, just why would you not drink another drink when your drink is finished? Like, that means it's finished. You need to do it again. Like, you just do it all over again. There's still beer. You need to keep drinking it. There's still vodka. Drink. What are you doing? Not drinking. And I remember I still got this idea in my head where it's like, if I don't drink this right now, I might never be able to drink ever again. So I'm, you know, and so the next night we did exactly the same thing. She drank 20 over 8 hours. I drank 20 in 30 minutes and passed out. Except this time we started a little bit earlier. So like, I'm awake from 10 to 1 p.m. and I go to sleep all afternoon. And that was what my drinking was like. That was the way it was. I was, so she broke up with me, and I was devastated, and I just stopped taking care of myself whatsoever. I started drinking every day. I discovered morning drinking. I discovered drinking to cure a hangover. I discovered that if you drank hard liquor at a party, people thought that you were really cool, so I just started doing that a lot. And I had a couple of big things happen sort of at the end that I still remember to this day as being the sort of things that, that I think of when I think about what alcoholism really means for me. First one was Chinese food. I had it was about a couple months afterwards, and I'm milking this breakup for all that it is worth. Like, if they're drinking and I'm upset, it's because she broke up with me. And she and her friends are showing up to parties, and I'm like insulting them and being really mean. Like, just this like evil core of my personality is coming out, where it's just like mean and cruel at people. Like, I do not care how you feel, because obviously you don't care about how I feel. And just being sad and mad, and as much as I can, drinking as much as I can, because now I think I've got a legitimate excuse. Like, I remember walking into somebody's room and just picking up their bottle and drinking it, because I thought that I had a right to it, because I was the one who was depressed and just got broken up with. Like, that's my thinking. You know, I'm learning enough about alcohol culture to know that somebody who's been broken up with needs a drink, and I just thought that all the 19-year-olds on my floor knew that. And so one day my friend Matt invites me to a party at his house. So I walk over and I bring my own bottle of Jack Daniels with me, because at this point I realized that I had had this thing where I did not want to drink all the alcohol at a party, but I knew that all the alcohol at a party was not going to be enough for me and everybody else to get drunk, so I brought my own. And so I'm sitting in a big sort of lazy boy seat, and I am drinking by myself and drinking as much other alcohol as I can, and just being upset and being silent and being stern and being quiet. And just like looking like that, and just getting drunk, and I black out, and I pass out in that chair, and everybody is like picking up Chinese food from ordering Chinese food, and like putting it on my head and seeing if I notice, and like putting dumpling in my ear and seeing if I notice. There's white kids at a college party. They just put food on you and they'll write on you if you don't take your shoes off or something weird, you know, clicky thing like that. So I wake up like 6 in the morning, and I am face down on the wood floor of my friend's bedroom. And I have done the thing where I have sweat and wet myself. But I had also sweat, and I sweat so much during the night, and then the sun came in through the window and dried all the sweat. So I have this like shame glaze all over me, and it's like glued to the ground, and I'm like prying my head off the ground and trying to get my bearings again. And I look over and I see my friend in bed with his girlfriend, and I have this realization. I'm like, I had always thought that I was like a cool guy who like people wanted to have at their parties, and like I wanted to show up, and I was just like recluse drinking guy. Like, I got this idea, like Bukowski, like I'm going to be that guy. Like, people aren't going to like me, but I'm going to win a Pulitzer and everything's going to be fine. But I just interrupted this guy's night. You know, he might have wanted to sit there with his girlfriend after the party and do what relationship people do. I'm not going to get into that. And I prevented him from doing that because I was passed on the ground. And it made sense. Like, I had always thought I contributed something. I contributed nothing. In fact, I took. I took from everybody that I met. And I just had this. I just had a moment where I was like, I never felt that low before. So I decided I was going to kill myself. I'm walking back like the half a mile to my dorm room, and I'm like, this is it. I'm going to kill myself. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. Those are the only words I knew how to describe being as depressed as I was. And I'm going to go, and I'm going to kill myself. I did not have any of the suicide accoutrement in my apartment. Like, I did not have any of that stuff. So I'm trying to look around, and I get back, and I'm like, how am I? I can't even kill myself. Like, I don't have, who has rope? Like, who's just hanging around with rope? You know? And so I don't have any of that, and, like, I don't have a knife, and I don't have any of that stuff. I don't have a gun. Like, it's D.C., not Virginia. I don't have a gun. And so I have one of those, like, Mach 3 blades. So I am taking a shoe, and I'm hitting the set of Mach 3 blades that maybe it's going to come apart, and I'll have a blade that I'll use to slit my wrist and kill myself. I figured that after I got the blades out, I would Google the rest. And I remember as I'm whacking this thing on my table, I remember that I have 3 Magic Hat number 9 in my little dorm fridge. And my roommate, who I tortured as his roommate. I was the worst roommate ever. Like, just if I stopped at like the degree at which I pissed this bed, like that would have been already a torture roommate. But I am like having parties here. He's just trying to study. Like, he's got like this wall of books protecting him from seeing me. Like, it's just bad. Like, I'm a bad roommate. Secondly, he showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous like 6 years later, and I recognized him in a meeting. I was like, I owe you an amends. And he was like, what? And we sat and talked about it for a little bit, and it was really beautiful. Yay, God, yay, yay, yay. But I'm pissing my bed at this point, so I get back in that room. He's asleep. This is how little I care about him and anybody else's feelings. I'm banging on a desk with my shoe, and he's passed out like 3 feet away. I just realized that right now. I do not care about anybody. And I do that, and I realize there's Magic Hat number 9 in the fridge. He wasn't drinking at this point. He was, like, trying to study and, like, trying to go to school and trying to do that. And he would never drink with me. So I was like, well, I'm not going to leave him for him. He's not going to drink him. So I abandoned my suicidal mission and drank 3 Magic Hat number 9, forgot to kill myself, and went to sleep. You know, you ever forget? It happened to me. Alcohol saved my life that day, as it often did. Alcohol saved my life. I don't know if I'd be here. I don't know whether my Googling would have, whether my shoe mission was going in the right direction. I definitely wasn't going to ask anybody. It's like, hey, you got a gun? You can come get it in 10 minutes. But I don't know if I was ever going to go through that. I don't know if that was ever going to work. But I know that I stopped trying once I got a little bit drunk, once I got to that magical spot between drink number 2 and drink number 3. It was all fine. It was all fine. Everybody was going to get over it. I was going to do better tomorrow. I was a pretty decent guy. It was going to be fine. What I didn't mention is that in between drinks, in between like finding that and writing the thing, I wrote this really long suicide note and I posted it on Facebook. You don't want to do that. And my parents read it because they have the internet. They have the internet. And so they pulled me out of school. I thought that they were cutting short a life with boundless potential and resented them. And we spent the next 3 weeks home fighting nonstop. I was drinking every single night and just sneaking out and stealing their car. Stealing a car, you can steal a car and bring it back. You just steal it more often. And so I stole a car every night. It was Christmas holiday, so like Christmas Eve dinner was me staring blankly at them and then saying, okay, can I leave now? And then leaving and going and get drunk, like, Merry Christmas. My parents and I are fighting. I'm getting into these altercations with my dad because they don't know what to do anymore. Like, they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do. I've been in therapy for my whole life. You know, they tried all that. They tried the anger. They tried withholding money. They tried withholding, like, they tried being stern. You know, like, I'm getting into these fights with my dad. My dad is not a violent guy. And they're just screaming at each other. And they're screaming at me. And my sister has completely gone into her own world. Like, the sad part about this, the thing that's not done yet, is that I don't really have much of a relationship with my sister. Like, all those formative years that we could have been talking, it was always like, you don't drink, so I don't care. And that's, like, she's in Birmingham, Alabama right now. I love this girl to death, and I do not know the first thing about her. We get together, I make her laugh, and I want more to happen with that. You know, my relationship with my parents has been completely restored thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. I will be forever grateful for that. Next step is the relationship that I have with my sister. And it's moments like that I look back and go, like, this whole chaos was happening, and she was just watching. She was just looking at it and going, like, what happened? What happened? What was going to happen? You know, I don't know. I don't know. Nobody knew. Nobody knew what was going on. There hasn't been any alcoholism in my family, ever. Like, my paternal grandmother, who died, my dad's mom, she smoked. Like, she was a smoker. And my mom's father was a smoker. But that's the only addiction, alcoholism, anything remotely overdue, whatever, that's in my family. So they were completely blindsided. They had absolutely no idea what was going on. So they tried counseling, they tried all this stuff, and none of it really worked. So this is 3-week period where I'm home. We're fighting every day. I am getting drunk every day. I'm stealing alcohol from them every day. And they've that beautiful little butler's pantry, there are now two padlocks on it, and I am breaking in through the top drawer and, like, pouring myself margaritas blind, like, trying to, like imagine one of those science experiments where, like, the glass room with the gloves, like, that's what I'm doing. Like, I'm blind measuring, like, a 3-1-1 margarita. Like, okay, I think that feels like the triple sec and measuring that in. I'm drinking I don't know what, but whenever they're not in the house, I'm stealing their booze because I feel entitled to it. And that's what our relationship is like. End of December, I am... I get invited to a party by one of my friends. Her name was Mackenzie, and she had, about 6 months earlier, she had joined this group called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were, they invited me to a Christmas party, and I decided I'd go, I went, and I could not have wanted to leave sooner. Like, it was the most uncomfortable place I'd ever been. Everyone was sitting there smiling, happy, and talking, and not drinking, and talking about how great their lives were, and I was just like, you're so self-centered talking about how great your lives are, I don't care. You guys don't care about how my life is at all. And so I left, and I called my two friends, and I was like, hey, we're going to get drunk tonight. We're going to party. And what a party looked like is that I would go down, and I would sneak, and I would steal some of my parents' wine, and we were going to drink it in my basement. You know, party. And so one of my friends drank a bottle of wine with us and left, and one of my friends drank six more bottles of wine with me and passed out, and I drank another five by myself. And I'm sitting, and I'm watching Scrubs on DVD in the basement. And when a DVD finishes, especially like a DVD season of a series, like a TV series, it just goes to this opening screen that just loops over and over and over again. And it is looping over and over again. And for Scrubs, it was this like banjo tune and just like the same 30 seconds over and over and over again. And it is burning a hole into my consciousness, except I am too drunk to find the remote. I am too drunk to go up and turn the TV off. I am too drunk to do anything except for drink. And I am still emotionally exactly the same way I was before I started drinking. I was, what's wrong with me? I'm not around anybody because I don't have any friends. What is going to happen next? I'm scared. I'm terrified. I'm worried. I feel exactly the same way I did before I started drinking, except I knew I was drunk, and I had this thought. I had the thought that I was not drinking in order to impress anybody. I was not drinking in order to be clever. I was not drinking in order to be sort of sardonic and witty and wise and getting to be an adult. I was not drinking. I wasn't even drinking to get drunk because I was hammered. I was drinking because I could no longer stop or control my drinking. And while I had that thought, I finished a bottle of wine and opened up another one. And I thought for a long time in AA that this was like a screw the world, like I'm just going to drink as much as I can anyway. But today I believe that I drank that drink involuntarily. I drank that drink even though I wanted to stop drinking, but there was still alcohol, so I was still going to drink it. It was out of my control. I drank involuntarily that night, and it scared the crap out of me. Because up until then, no matter what anybody else said, alcohol was in my corner. Alcohol was the thing that was going to make it okay, and alcohol was no longer okay. Alcohol was no longer in my corner. Alcohol was this thing, and whenever I drank, I did not know what was going to happen, but I knew that not drinking was just not going to happen. So I was kind of scared. That was the thought that was going through my head a couple days later when my friend Mackenzie, who invited me to that party, her sister had also gotten sober. She's not anymore, but Mackenzie is. Mackenzie is running pretty close to 10 years now. She's still a really good friend of mine. And her sister, Haley, came to me while I was at my job, which was barbacking and stealing liquor from a mall bar, like one of those bars, nameless, that sits inside a mall that the parents go to get drunk while the kids are wandering around looking for KB toys or whatever. And I walk around outside, and they go, and she goes, "Hey, Adam," and I go, "Hey, Haley," and she goes, "Hey, are you done trying to kill yourself?" And I thought of being in the basement with the wine, and I said, "Yeah." And that feeling was short-lived, but they took advantage of that for all they could. They were trying to find a rehab for me to get into in like the New Jersey area. So we would go to one, and I would lie my way out of it, and then we'd go to another one, and I'd lie my way out of it. Like I have this uncanny ability to make people like me if I really want, especially when I just meet them. And for me, that means that, like, you know, everything's okay. Everything's fine. Like, I'm doing okay. They're just making a really big deal out of something. And, like, they let me out, and I go, ha ha. And they're like, all right, more driving. And so they eventually found a place that wouldn't ask me any questions before they took me in. It was called Endeavor House, and it was in Keyport, New Jersey. Keyport is also commonly known as Cirrhosis by the Sea. It is an area of New Jersey where if you are not drinking yourself to death and you are not in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, you are commuting through it. Like, there is nobody else. When I was in Endeavor House is sort of on a dead end block next to the Hudson River, and on the other corner was a liquor store. On the opposite corner was a head shop, and the other corner was a bar. So they would always tell us, like, okay, if you want to leave, you don't really have to go that far. You can even come back and sleep it off. You know, and that was the way that, was the way they talked about it. So I checked into this place. I make a deal with my parents that I can go to a concert the night before because, like, if you really love me, you let me have fun. Duh. And they, so they, I go to a concert on December 31st, 2006. And I only have a dollar to my name. And somebody's selling a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon out of the trunk of a car for a buck. We make a deal. I drink a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon. I don't get even anywhere close to drunk. And I spend the entire night inside this concert going, everybody is having fun except for me. What is wrong with me? If I'd known that was going to be my last drink, I would have stolen something because that was going to be a big deal. But that was it. And then the next day, they drove me to a rehab. My parents said, you should probably get this figured out. And I said, well, when I get out of here, this isn't going to work, and I don't even want to know you guys anymore. And my mom was crying as she drove away. And that was our relationship before I was introduced to you. Thank God for AA. Thank God for AA. That was how I showed up, 19 and a half, sickly and angry at absolutely everybody for not letting me do exactly what I wanted to do at that moment in time. It started with small, seemingly minute spiritual experiences that sort of compounded into the big one. And it started with these moments where somebody would come in and they would tell a story. And they wouldn't tell a story about, like gratuitous violence and, like, oh, man, like, the shame, incomprehensible demoralization. Like, just saying the word, I know what it means, but it doesn't convince me that you've got it and that you understand what it was like for me. You know, but when you tell stories that seemingly have nothing to do with me, I can look into them and find the gem of identification out of them. And involuntarily, like, I just hear it and it connects with me at some, like, dark point in my soul. And somebody comes into, I'm like 4 days in there, and somebody tells this story about how he was 14 years old and he just started drinking and he played on a baseball team. And he loved playing baseball. He loved looking forward to baseball every single day until one day drinking conflicted with baseball, and then he just dropped baseball, like wasn't even a second thought, and he didn't look back, and that exact same experience happened to me. And I knew exactly why he did it, and it made sense, and I went, oh, man, I'm alcoholic. Not because I understood it, but just because he said it, and I was whatever he was. You know, I remember a couple days later, like, trying to do the rehab version of steps, which where step one is stop trying to run away. and step two is stop fighting with your counselors. And, like, trying to do the regimental thing and trying to figure out what my higher power was. And my higher power was going to be knowledge and self-knowledge. And I was going to depend on the knowledge of AA, and I was going to figure it out. And that was going to be what I was going to trust because I wasn't going to believe in any of that God crap. I was obviously too good for that. And I told this story to somebody who at the time I think had 3 or 4 years sober. And he goes, when are you going to realize your brain ain't going to fix you? And all of a sudden, just having this moment of, like, finally being confronted with what I actually believed and realizing how much it was found wanting. Like, how much when somebody else said it, how much when it was let out of my head that it just didn't match up with the things that were going to happen to me. And just getting incredibly angry at God and having this experience of finally having, like, years and years of resentment and fear getting washed away. And realizing that there was something to this thing. There was something going on here. And that if I hung close to this, something really nice was going to happen. You know, years later, the first experience that I had sharing honestly with another alcoholic, as honestly as I could be, I don't believe in anything like a bad program or a bad fourth step. I hear people talking like, I wasn't honest at all in my fourth step. Like, my fourth step was crap. You know, like, that fourth step sucks. You got to be working a good program and stuff like that. And I don't believe in that at all. Like, that just has not been my experience. Like, I am as honest and as willing as I can be at every moment of every day. And to expect differently since I've come past that is just another excuse for me to hate myself or for me to condemn myself for something I had no control over. I had no way to do it. I did absolutely the best fourth step that I was capable of doing. That involved me speaking a lot in generalities is the word I was looking for before my tongue tried to kill me. And it, like, I spoke a lot in generalities and I didn't speak in specifics. I told a lot about how awful I was and how awful I felt, but I couldn't tell anybody any stories because I was still so ashamed and I didn't think, and the way I got away with it was I didn't think it mattered. And how much time do I have left? Like minutes? Seconds? All right. So I had more and more of these experiences where after giving that not good enough, not good program fourth step where I didn't share honestly with a sponsor, I felt lighter than air. I felt like finally somebody could look at me and understood who I really was. And I walked away from that feeling like I was finally a member of AA. You know, sitting down with my parents and telling honestly about the way that I behaved in a way where I actually communicated that I knew. You know, and having my mom respond and my parents respond in the way that they did, which was that they loved me and that they wanted me to succeed and that they were going to be with me every step of the way and that they were going to help me with whatever I could. And realizing that, like, the relationship that we'd had was not because they hated me. It was because I just couldn't meet them on their level. The feeling of being in a home group, You know, like my home group is Hope Is Here. I should have said that at the very beginning. I realized I forgot something. My home group is Hope Is Here. It's in Alexandria, Virginia on Tuesday nights at 8:30. I would love it if you came. We're always looking for new people to come and tell us how to do our thing. And I love the feeling that I get when I walk into my home group every week and realize that there are 40 people in that meeting who know exactly how it's going with me at every single moment, and that any pretense or dishonesty is just completely useless. Like, they're just like, really? Why? It's like going to war with the U.S. and you're like Florida. It's like, okay, good, have fun. Have fun, guys, for the 35-second war. We have nuclear weapons. You have sticks and a boat. Like, have fun. And, like, that's what it felt like. It felt like, how could I be dishonest with them? They know. And so I can just look at them and tell them exactly how I'm doing at that moment. You know, the feeling of finally feeling a part of, and knowing that it's not because of something I said or something that I did. Because it was me, and because I could finally be me. Like, I wouldn't have traded any of the gradual experiences that have brought me close to this relationship with God, where I know deep down in my soul that everything is going to be okay, that nothing is as heart attack serious as I always made it out to be, that nobody can eat me, none of the horrible things that I imagined were going to happen to me as a result of me screwing up or telling somebody who I really was or making a mistake were ever going to happen, and that I was safe and protected every day, and that I could then take that and do things that I thought were impossible. Like, that spiritual experience, everything that happened up until then and everything afterwards has been a blessing and a joy. And all I can bring to that is that when you guys ask me to come and tell you what it meant for me to be an alcoholic, I can contribute just for an hour, just once, and just say, like, this is what it means for me. If something about this struck true to you and you're wondering if you've got this thing, then welcome. Thanks.